Everything is illusion. Family, office, friends, the street, the woman. All illusion, drawing nearer and further away. But the nearest truth is merely that I push my head against the wall of a cell without doors or windows. An aphorism by the Czech writer Franz Kafka that could indeed stand for so much of his work, unflinching and disciplined, and profoundly difficult. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Trial, Der Prozess, perhaps Kafka's most famous novel. To make sense of Kafka and The Trial, we are joined by Karolina Votroba, author of Metamorphoses in Search of Franz Kafka, a journey through a century of Kafka's readers and readings, some of them more accurate than others. Welcome, Karolina.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First off, I'd like you to take us through the story of the publication of The Trial. Franz Kafka, of course, very little of his work was published in his lifetime. How did it come to be published in 1925? What were the controversies over how it was edited and the shape of it? And could you also take us through other elements of that story? How did Kafka's oeuvre actually come into being as something we can now read and digest?
Right. So Kafka dies in 1924. He's 40 years old. He dies of the complications of tuberculosis. And as you say, he has not published a lot before his death, but he has a lot of manuscripts literally in the drawers of his desk. And the person who gets his hands on the manuscripts is Max Brod, who was Kafka's best friend. And already during his life, he acted as a sort of unofficial literary agent, almost, to him, we could say. So whatever Kafka did publish during his lifetime, it was usually through the encouragement or even urging and the connections that Max Brod introduced to him.
And he was a significant figure in his own right, Brod.
Exactly. So at the time, during Kafka's lifetime, Brod was by far the more famous and influential and well-connected writer of the two. But Brod always thought that Kafka was the more talented of the two. He thought that he had a literary genius on his hands, and he made it his mission to find Kafka readers. Kafka had very ambivalent feelings about this. Like many writers, he was sort of torn between creative inspiration and faith and conviction that he was creating something very special, and crippling anxiety, writer's block, doubts, shame. And he was sort of going from one to the other. And at one of his low points, he talked to Brod and actually asked him to burn all of his manuscripts after his death. Brod was the least likely person to do it, which Kafka must have realized. So how seriously we should take that request, that testament that Kafka left behind, you know, scholars have argued about for decades. But the facts are, Brod did not burn anything. He actually even sort of went around and talked to other friends of Kafka's who had some other manuscripts, and he tried to collect everything that he could. And he protected them, you know, through the turbulences of the 20th century. The manuscript zigzagged and crisscrossed Europe back and forth. And immediately after Kafka's death, Brod started publishing what he had. But he first had to edit everything for publication, because these were really manuscripts in their rawest form. So they were just heaps of loose sheets, dozens of notebooks. Often Kafka would actually start several writing projects in one notebook, and he wouldn't make it quite clear how these different fragments were connected or whether they were connected at all. He would produce versions of certain passages. He would sometimes actually tear apart notebooks and sort of reconstitute stories. Often he would have sections, but wouldn't leave behind any notes as to what order he was imagining for them. So Brod had to do a lot of editing, and he decided that the first order of business would be to edit the three novels that Kafka drafted but never published. And The Trial, The Prozess, was one of them. it wasn't chronologically the first one that Kafka had composed. So he wrote it in about 6 months in the second half of 1914. And then the very beginning of 1915, he pretty much abandoned the manuscript. So 10 years later, Broad takes this novel, edits it. And his thinking is that to really establish Kafka as a literary name, he needs a longer piece rather than a short story or a collection of aphorisms, and that this would need to read as a finished product. So he wanted a beginning and an end. He wanted something where all the sentences were finished, where the progression of episodes more or less made sense. But this was not the text that Kafka left behind. In the text that Kafka left behind, there is no set order of the chapters. Some chapters Kafka began but didn't finish. Sometimes you just have a sort of sentence that doesn't even have a full stop, just breaks off halfway through. Broad also standardized punctuation, spellings. He really wanted for the book to look very neat and recognizable as a finished novel. And this was the source of all of these decades of controversies about Broad's editing, because soon editing standards would change and modern day editions of Kafka go back to a lot of this unfinished quality of his drafts and actually see that as something really exciting. We can perhaps talk about why. And on top of that, there is this whole ongoing question of Kafka's testament and Kafka's request to have the manuscripts burned. So this created a lot of controversy, which, however, I think actually helped the novel, because this was widely discussed in the press and people were sort of taking a stand on whether they thought Broad was right or wrong to publish. And that really created a buzz around this novel in 1925.
Yes, I sort of wonder whether there's a kind of high degree of self-consciousness in the idea that Virgil also asked for his poems to be burnt. So it's sort of self-referential in a way. Like great writers of the past have made this request and been ignored. Could you take us... You're right about the trial. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying he actually wrote the end before he wrote anything else. And the end has some curious qualities, which I guess we can talk through. But could you take us through the structure of the novel as Broad edited it and give us some of its qualities? Because at times it's got a bit of a Shaggy Dog story quality and it's sort of hard to describe. So, you know, if you could do that, that'd be great.
Yes. So what Kafka was certain about was the beginning. He knew what he wanted the first sentence to be. It is one of those really famous openings in the history of literature. We have this protagonist, Josef K., who is 30 years old, and he gets arrested for an unknown crime. This already sets up the guiding questions of the novels. What did Josef K. do? Did he do anything? Is he guilty? Is he not guilty? What is the nature of this arrest? Because it's not really a typical arrest as we understand it. He's not really taken anywhere. He is just informed that he is now under arrest, but that this will actually not interfere with his day-to-day life. Who is the court who has ordered this arrest is another question that already opens up in this opening passage. So Kafka knew that this is where he wanted the story to start. And because he had already been struggling with writer's block so many times in the preceding decade or so, he came up with this plan that he would follow his opening paragraph with the last paragraph, with where he wanted the plot to arrive at the end. So he laid out a chronology for himself by writing this closing paragraph that would take place a year after the initial arrest. And it would be, in many ways, a sort of a mirror scene of the opening scene, with two people showing up and taking Josef K. to a quarry and then putting a knife through his heart. And as he dies, he thinks to himself, like a dog. So this really abject, powerful, impactful, and still really unexplained, or perhaps even on a deeper metaphysical level, inexplicable death scene. So this much was clear for Kafka from the beginning. But then what would happen between those two scenes, he never quite arrived at a conclusion there. So the structure we are left with is quite a circular type of structure where we have certain episodes and recurring characters, and Josef K. quite literally going around in circles, trying to progress his trial, trying to gather information about this shadowy court, trying to meet people who could help him, but again and again being disappointed, being thwarted in his efforts to actually talk to somebody who is responsible for his trial, and just coming across all of these strange figures hidden in some dusty, dilapidated old houses in the center of this town, unidentified town, which however sounds quite a bit like Prague, Kafka's hometown. So the story involves quite a lot of repetition, often almost identical scenes repeated with a little bit of a difference, and also repetition between characters who resemble characters who had already appeared before. So there's a whole series of women, for example, who Josefka perceives as seductresses, appearing in a lot of those episodes. There's also quite a few men who claim to be in a position of authority and able to influence the trial, and they all invariably disappoint Josefka. And that circular structure, which Kafka clearly found on some level frustrating and was trying to get beyond it by executing that sort of linear scaffolding for himself, that circular structure, however, is much of what really makes the trial the novel that it is, and that I think has continued to captivate readers for such a long time, because it does capture, it contributes so much to that suffocating effect of those interminable bureaucratic processes that go around in circles, that do not bring resolution, and as Josefka at some point finds out, where the whole logic actually seems to be that your best bet is to keep your trial going, to keep extending it, that you can't actually hope for any more definitive resolution than just for it to never end.
Yeah, his case sort of begins to consume him in a way. Mm. The other aspects of it, I think there are many resonances, and all of Kafka's work sort of feels interrelated. But he's a successful character, is that right? He works in a bank. At the start, he sort of communicates throughout the novel he has a degree of status. You know, could you explore that kind of social element?
Yes. So as readers, we see a lot of the events very squarely through Josefka's perspective. And there are many moments when we actually suddenly realize that perhaps what we had taken to be the case is more Josefka's own interpretation of events, which, however, could be wrong. And I think his own quite almost defensive assertion of his status is one of those cases. So as you say, he is working at the bank. He seems to be externally quite successful. And then he thinks, oh, things are starting to go badly at work because of my trial. But there are lots of small indications that actually maybe things had already started going wrong, and that actually there is quite a lot of animosity and tension between Josefka and his co-workers. Similarly, in his relationships with women, he seems to think of himself as sort of quite attractive and having different relationships. But actually, sort of the deeper we get into the novel, the more we start realizing that actually his advances are quite unwelcome, and that in fact he comes across as a very lonely character. So there are lots of little hints that actually maybe there was already something going decisively wrong in his life. And of course, the reader is being sort of invited to start thinking, aha, so maybe there was some sort of crime that he committed, that he is just in denial about himself. And so in this way, we get actually drawn to that kind of sick logic of the court, where we start almost forensically examining the text for clues as to what might have happened before the beginning of the novel, and by extension, the beginning of Josefka's trial. And that's a really interesting mechanism that I think really influences how it feels to read this novel.
Yeah, as you say, he's drawn into this complicity or kind of emotional sympathy with the trial, the process itself. And I think it would be an entirely uninteresting novel in a way if he was just the innocent victim of an oppressive force. It's much more It's much more disturbing than that. There's this kind of sense in which the victim of an oppressive authority is in some strange way, you know, stains and there's a contagion that goes on, that there is, and that kind of comes through. There are various squalid little scenes in the novel that I'd like mm-hmm. to talk about. There are nasty moments, and yet mm-hmm. they're narrated with a kind of methodical practicality, which is, I think, one of the taproots of Kafka's interest. He doesn't let up. There are horrible sort of S&M scenes of bullying, of physical abuse. Mm-hmm. Various sexual assaults happen in the mm-hmm. text, which Josef, one of which he sees quite early on. But it's done, yeah, with this kind of extraordinary discipline. You kind of read it and then you reflect 5 minutes later, God, that was really horrible, you know, that moment. But at the time, it's sort of, you're caught in the kind of blankness. But that dynamic, he may not be innocent, so innocent after all, is highly disturbing.
Yeah, I think you've described it quite well there. It's that sort of dispassionate, very detail-oriented style of description. And it is, as you say, only a few minutes later that we start realizing actually the details that were emphasized were not the ones that were really important. Mm. And they are almost sort of tempting us to, as you say, overlook the actually really disturbing aspects of what is happening. And this is, again, often achieved by what in literary scholarship we call focalization. So this third person narrator, despite being in the third person, is very much uses the thinking and the perceptions of Josef K. as a lens, as really the only lens through which we have access to what is happening. And it seems that as a sort of protective or self-defense mechanism, Josef K. often at very disturbing moments where violence is being committed, often sexual violence, or where something is really off in some other way, he just zooms in on some unrelated or only tangentially related detail and really focuses on that. This is often an element of somebody's clothing. So we get an over-detailed description of what somebody is wearing while that person is being beaten up, for example. So those are mechanisms that are really hallmarks of Kafka's style, and they produce this sort of haunting quality, and they produce that feeling of complicity that you've been talking about, not just before Josef K. and this sort of under-specified regime that has some sort of authoritarian overtones, but also between us as readers and us, as you say, having to really be on our guard to sort of engage our moral faculties in evaluating what it is that we're seeing. Mm. And one of these scenes that I think we've been alluding to is the scene when Josef K. is at work and he opens the door to some sort of random little room down the corridor from his office, and he sees the two men who first showed up at his house to inform him of his arrest being beaten up by another man who was bare-chested, and the rest of his outfit is leather. So these are the bizarre sexual connotations that are never quite explained, do not make really sense in the context. And Josef K. is trying to stop this beating, but he doesn't manage to do that. And then on another day, he goes down that same corridor, opens the same door, sees the same scene, and just closes the door and never opens it again. And these scenes are so powerful because they are so full of detail and so visceral, but at the same time, it's hard to resist the impression that there's just some sort of symbolic force hitting you through these mm-hmm. scenes. And this scene in particular has often been interpreted as a very Freudian scene, where this little room, which in German is called Rumpelkammer, so the kind of room where you would just sort of leave unwanted furniture and like leftover bits and bobs from other parts of the building, that this is the sort of Freudian id. So your unconscious, your drives that you're ashamed of, and that this is the visualization of what is really going on in Josef K. And when he chooses to just close the door and never look at it again, he is essentially choosing to never really consider his guilt or his culpability. So there is that this symbolic reading really suggests itself, but at the same time, the text resists it because of the practical detail of this whole scene that is so forceful that it just feels wrong to just sort of interpret it straight away, go to this more like metaphysical or symbolic meaning.
Yes, you've hit the nail on the head that it's very, very tempting with Kafka to read all these symbols into it. But then the text always defeats that process. So in Metamorphosis, Die Verwandlung, the opening section in which Gregor Samsa wakes up as an insect or a beetle or vermin or something like that, and the first passage reads something like, Gregor had a night of troubled sleep. And when he wakes up, he feels that he's in this transformation. Immediately, what then happens is his ego state, to speak in Freudian terms, kicks in and says to Gregor, you have to go to work. The way you're going to solve this feeling of restlessness is go to work, make sure you get to the train on time, go out to help your family. And it is this idea of, and sleep is very important in Freud, this idea of sleep being this realm of the unconscious. If you don't want to go to sleep, you're really resisting the power of the unconscious. And it's very interesting, the father of Gregor in Metamorphosis spends one important scene trying not to fall asleep, as if he's sort of scared of this eruption of the unconscious that Gregor in some ways represents. But in a sense, we could go through, and so many people have read through these symbols and impose their own kind of lens. But ultimately, you're right, the text itself defeats it because it grounds everything in this, like, it's like a kind of blankness leading to another blankness, this like affectless register. I think one of the most thrilling images in the whole of Kafka is in the trial, when Joseph is in that attic of the court. So he's following a woman who's just been assaulted into an attic, and he's sort of being led through these attic spaces by one of the officers, the attendants of the court, and he begins to feel very sick. And then someone helps him and says, Joseph, you don't look great, let me open up a skylight. And she tries to open the skylight above him, and all that happens is soot sort of falls over them and falls over Joseph's hands, and it blackens everything. And they don't open the skylight at all. And I think that's such a wonderful image of Kafka. There is no romantic image of nature, for example, that can kind of rescue the world. It's just, this kind of disciplined blank interiority that leads to an outer blankness. What's curious about Kafka, he's sort of so unrelenting. I think many other writers would have sort of shied away from that in the end, but he doesn't. Mm. And there are lots of very interesting inversions. The one scene is lit by moonlight, and you think of that Eichendorfer Mondnacht, is a beautiful image of the moonlight pervading our senses and experience. And all that moonlight illuminates in the trial is a kind of horrible, confusing, sort of strange conversations, a horrible interaction with another female character, Lainey, who's this kind of grotesque woman with webbed fingers, and he sort of looks at these fingers with fascination. And it's very hard, I think, in the trial, sorry, I'm slightly rambling, but because I love this novel so much, and it's very hard to know what time it is. That's true also of In the Penal Colony, another of Kafka's short stories, where it's actually set in the blazing heat of the middle of the day. But because of the atmosphere of the story, which is this kind of dark hell, you sort of don't feel that. And you have to be reminded that it's actually set in the bright sunlight, whereas actually you feel that all the action is taking place deep underground. But yeah, I just could you extend that idea, I guess, of why Kafka's metaphysics is so hard to grapple with? I think this idea of difficulty is important.
Yeah, so I agree that it is so relentless and unrelenting, and yeah, there's never pleasant sunshine. There's just oppressive heat. It's the only kind of sunshine that exists in Kafka. But at the same time, I think these books would be very different had Kafka not infused them also with a sense of off-kilter humor. So this relentless energy that sort of propels the characters to go in circles also has a comical side to it. And this is something that was extremely important to Kafka, and that was glaringly obvious to his first readers, his friends, Max Brod and others in their circles in Prague. So we know from various sources that often when Kafka would read out something to his friends, including passages that he was working on, and including even whole finished pieces like Das Urteil, so The Judgment, they would laugh. They would laugh their heads off. They found it hilarious. And Kafka himself also found it funny. And I think that humor comes out partly of that narrative style that you've been trying to describe, that sort of mismatch between what is happening and how it's being reported to us. And it's also there in those grotesque moments, like Lenny's webbed fingers, the fact that female characters are always so comically unappealing and off-putting to those anxious male protagonists. It's there in the little details and in the mismatch between how people respond to what is happening. There's sort of just about enough levity there that the tone that he's writing has that sort of quality to it that means it's not Dostoevsky, that there is a certain lightness of touch to it, which I think really rounds off that experience of reading Kafka.
Yeah, many double meanings in the German as well. And that's you know, if you could convey what it's like to read Kafka in the German to our kind of English listeners, that would be helpful.
Yeah, the first thing I would say is that because of the differences in German grammar, especially syntax, so how sentences are put together between German and English, reading Kafka in German has a sense of sort of limpid clarity that is sometimes very difficult to get in English. So for example, if you think about the first sentence of the Metamorphosis, you know, many fantastic translators have translated this story and tried their hand at sort of conveying that first sentence. It always comes with certain syntactic awkwardness because there's just so many little clauses in that first sentence that have to all be in there because they're all important. It's the, you know, the uneasy dreams, the he woke up right there in his bed, all of these tiny things. And no matter how you toss them around, it always, like, you have to have some commas in there in English. You have to put that sentence together out of clauses that grammatically do not quite mesh together in English. Whereas in German, there's only one possible word order for that quite long sentence. Everything is dictated by the grammar. It's from the first word, which is als, which means when in the past. That first word already dictates where the verb is going to go, and that dictates where the subject is going to go, and that dictates where all of the little clauses are going to go. So there is this sense of inexorable progression from the first to the last sentence of each word of each sentence. And Kafka really exploits that. He loves using relative clauses and the whole variety of available conjunctions in German, all of these little words which make it look like there's a logical cause and effect order to what is being described, even though, as we've been talking, it's precisely that logical consequences that are lacking.
Yes, and there are some sentences which are basically a page long in Metamorphosis.
Exactly. And in German, he always writes it in a way that is absolutely clear. He's actually very easy to read in German. Mm. And in English, just because of how the grammar works, I think that sense of clarity and ease and the almost sort of troubling ease with which these sentences roll along and sort of sound logical and sound extremely well thought through, even though the things being described do not quite make sense, I feel like that's extremely difficult to render well in English.
It's used as an A-level text in England, at any rate. And that goes right to the heart of Metamorphosis. I know we're talking about the trial, but that phrase, ungeheures Ungeziefer, which is what stands for the insects, or the vermin. Could you give an idea of how that sounds in German? Because it's very difficult to capture in English, and I'm not sure any translation has ever captured how that feels.
Yes, so there's so much in there in the German that, you know, going back to sort of medieval etymologies of these words, but also their morphology and what they sound like. So the first thing to say is that these are both negatives. So they start with un, which, like an in English, means not something. So Gregor Samsa is being defined by what he is not. And now ungeheuer in modern usage means sort of two things. It means huge and sort of unpleasant or scary. So in English, many translators render it with the word monstrous, which also has the sort of both the size and the affective impact. But it comes originally from the word geheuer, which meant something like familiar, connected to home. So in that sense, ungeheuer almost is like uncanny, because it's unfamiliar. home-like, let's say. And then Ungeziefer is even more interesting and more layered because it's, again, morphologically, it's a negative, so it's negating something. And what it's negating is, going back to its medieval roots, an animal unfit for religious sacrifice. As the word has developed over centuries, it's acquired the meaning of insect or vermin, and it's an uncountable noun, like vermin. So it can be used for a single thing, like in the story, but it also implies a sort of threatening mass. And for that reason, it has a long history of being used as a slur, specifically an anti-Semitic slur in Kafka's time. And when you combine the two, you get an image that is both very layered and triggers a certain emotional response in German readers, both in Kafka's time and still today. And at the same time, it's sort of curiously underspecified because of that double negative. And because it's not a specific kind of insect, the word itself, you know, it's clear from the story that it is an insect, but the word itself could also mean something like mice or rats.
And it's specifically the word that the Nazis used for Jews.
Yeah, after Kafka's death. But it was already on its way to being used in that way during his lifetime. So, yeah, that's just a little example of how Kafka is working with language to sort of activating these connotations and associations that often go back centuries. And in this case, it's sort of doubly important because Kafka, we know from his letters to his editors and publishers that he really didn't want this insect-like creature to be portrayed visually anywhere in the book. He wanted it to be something that you cannot quite picture, even though we do get a description of what this creature looks like. He thought it would be much more effective to just sort of have a sense of what it is, but the real sort of abject fear comes from not quite being able to visualize it.
I think it's interesting, Carolina, what you said about the humor there, mm-hmm. because I remember a conversation between, I think it was Milan Kundera and Philip Roth, who wanted to turn the trial into a Marx Brothers film. Because I think the point that Roth was making is that humour doesn't necessarily come across in English translations. And I think, interestingly, Kafka was one of the first of two authors I read of serious novelist, European novelist in translation. The other was Camus. And so I always think of Kafka in a certain sense as something that appeals to the adolescent mind, if you know what I mean, in terms of, obviously with Camus, it's existentialism. With Kafka, it could be argued it's alienation. But he seems to change over time. And there's a mythology around Kafka, of course, the word Kafkaesque, that imagines a world. And there are very, very few authors that have that. I suppose Samuel Beckett would be the closest equivalent when we think of a Beckettian world. But I remember going to Prague in about 1987, 88. So Czechoslovakia was still behind the wall, and going to Kafka's grave in the cemetery there. And it was pretty obvious the authorities there couldn't really hide the fact that he was there, but felt very uncomfortable with him. And the value of Kafka as a figure then was almost a prophetic figure of totalitarianism. Even though he didn't live in a totalitarian system, he seemed to imagine that. And I wonder how much of his reputation is not just that he's a great writer and his work is malleable, as all great art is, and it reflects the day and the circumstances in which we live. And there's always a contingent element to that. So for the people in the late 80s in Eastern Europe, he was this totemic figure who was banned. His work was sent around by Samizdat. And I just wonder what he's become now and how he reflects the culture now, because there was a phrase in the trial that says he'd always tended to take things lightly, to believe the worst only when it arrived, making no provision for the future, even when things looked bad. And that is a phrase that so appeals to now in the West's lack of resilience, its lack of foresight about the crisis that's coming, the crisis we're in. And so because of the brilliance of the work, it always can appeal to present circumstance. And so my question is, if he is this prophet of totalitarianism, if he speaks to us now as an unprepared world in crisis, what was he talking about when he wrote it in 1914, when he wrote it on the eve of this catastrophe within the Austro-Hungarian Empire? How did they view it then, and what was it telling them?
Okay, well, there's a lot there in your question. So let me start with the, you know, the Marx brothers and the comedy. I think this is spot on, at least because Kafka was a big fan of Charlie Chaplin, for example. He loved that kind of cinema. He found it laugh out loud funny. And his works are full of this sort of bodily comedy, reminiscent of those early silent films. And I think that actually also works with the second part of your question, which is about, you know, Kafka as a prophet of totalitarianisms, which is how he started being read quite early on. Hannah Arendt, for example, famously saw him that way. Sartre and de Beauvoir also read him like this as early as 1938, 1939, as, you know, the Second World War was coming. They were reading Kafka and they were corresponding and telling each other that this war is beginning as if Kafka had scripted it. And they meant specifically because it's sort of everybody is expecting it to come and it hasn't quite come yet. So there was something about Kafka that people were responding to, which was both sort of deadly serious, but also, again, that sort of dark comedy of how it is to actually live through a catastrophe like this. And when I think about the trial and those scenes where Josef K. actually manages to get himself into a courtroom and witness something that he is expecting to be the criminal proceedings against himself, and it's some sort of wild spectacle, and he then finds out that the only papers that the judge is actually using are some pornographic magazines. I mean, this again speaks so much to the sort of spectacle of political theater today and these authoritarian figures today. And I think he just has such a good sense of that, of just how ridiculous and comical that deep tragedy is, that is what resonates today a lot, I think. But then what you were saying at the end there about, you know, what it was like in 1914. So yeah, he starts writing the trial in August, right? So such a sort of date pregnant implications. And he is clearly thinking about the bureaucratic structures that he is familiar with from his own life. So the Austro-Hungarian bureaucracy that was widely seen as sort of the most involved and protracted and complex and multi-layered in all of Europe. And he was part of it. He was a cog in the machine because his day job was really as a civil servant, as a lawyer in one of the sort of many, many institutes and public official initiatives that made up this sort of gargantuan bureaucracy, looking specifically at sort of emerging work accident insurance schemes. So he knew exactly how it was to be both a cog in that machine, but also a subject to it as a citizen of that state. And I think that's where both the sort of specificity and the universality of it comes from, is that he was often describing closely observed patterns of behavior, types of personalities that emerge in these kinds of systems, but he was never describing it in the context of Austro-Hungarian bureaucracy specifically. But he was always sort of relocating it to somewhere else, be it ancient China, for example, or some sort of abstract scenario of the kind that we have in the trial, where the town where this is set has no name, the time at which this is happening is not indicated. And I think that's part of what makes it so portable and what makes it travel so well and resonate so much, as you say, in, you know, during the Cold War, but also in places far away in very different contexts, like, for example, in South Korea during the military dictatorships. And
he seems to be sort of born immaculate in some way, sui generis, Franz Kafka. Do you pinpoint any particular literary influences on him?
Yes, so he read a lot. He read very eclectically. He had no sort of conservative sense of what is sort of highbrow and serious and what's lowbrow and a waste of time. But he read everything from Flaubert, who he adored, all the way to sort of adventure novels set in South America that he sort of eagerly collected. Some particularly big influences on him, when you look at them, it also becomes clear how sort of eclectic and how his intellectual horizon really went beyond just that quite small community of German-speaking Jews in Prague around the turn of the century. So I've already mentioned Flaubert. He was also very interested in the sort of German classics, you know, Goethe, that kind of thing, Austrian literature as well. But then he read a lot of Czech literature, which was not a given for people in his milieu, but he was fluent in Czech. And Božena Nemcová, a great realist novelist, 19th century novelist, he's read a lot of her writings, and we can see very specifically how even some sort of settings and details of plots are influenced by her, especially in The Castle, so the other still great novel that we all know about. But then he also got very interested in Yiddish theater, a troupe of actors who came from Warsaw and gave a series of performances in Prague, and he became great personal friends with many of them and actually even gave a lecture to the Prague audience introducing their art. And a lot of what he liked about it was the sense of dynamism that he saw in it, again, the sort of bodily comedy. But then one of his favorite books was a collection of Chinese poetry over the centuries, and he would often excerpt from it in his letters to some of the women he was involved with. So there was really no end to his literary fascinations. And I think he strikes us as very postmodern in the combination of what he enjoyed reading. And you can really see traces of all of it in there, including those, you know, cheap adventure novels set in South America. This is part of where his fascination with exotic locales of the kind he'd never visited himself stems from.
With Flaubert, you think of the way in which Flaubert never really turns down the temperature on his protagonist. That really resonates with Kafka. And Goethe, this idea that the writer takes on the burden of his age is a kind of crucible through which all the things you observe out of you run. And I think that Kafka is authentically doing that. And potentially that's what explains some of his melancholy, of feeling like he is a writer, but that imposes a kind of horrible burden on him. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that is perhaps where some of that anxiety stemmed from. But I think with Goethe, it is very characteristic just of how Kafka's fascination with Goethe really plays out. So he does read quite a bit of Goethe, but the moment when he sort of writes him the most about him the most in his diaries, for example, is when he goes on a trip to Weimar, so the city associated with Goethe. And then, you know, what he gives you is really the kind of tourist excited to be in a place where this great figure lived. So reading those diary entries, you don't get the impression of, you know, here is a great writer in the making, visiting, you know, doing almost a pilgrimage to his great literary predecessor. You get more the idea of an excited tourist trying to take in all the attractions and then sort of becoming weirdly, inappropriately attracted to the daughter of the housekeeper at Goethe House. So I think that that's an example of how Kafka sort of evokes certain expectations and conventions and then sort of subverts them, often in bizarre and darkly comical ways.
And the name of the sort of little story you talked about, that the girl in the house is Greta, isn't it? Which is the same as in the girl in Faust. I wonder if that's true or he's making it up. You're right, it's this kind of slightly off-kilter, it's almost slapstick, but fascinating. Yeah, talking about his literary antecedents, but I would like to broach the dreaded Kafkaesque word, and I think it is pretty remarkable that it exists as a standalone phrase in about 100 languages. George Steiner, the literary critic, observed that it even retained its solidity in Japanese. And actually, there's plenty of Japanese literature which is authentically playing off Kafka. In that Goethean sense, he does sort of assume the baggage of his time. He is a truly great figure, I think, Kafka. And that's why he lasts, and that's why people keep coming back to him. But he also seems to me someone who is powerfully misread quite a lot. There's like profoundly, he's just a profoundly difficult writer, actually. In your book, you give quite a few examples of people who are sort of seduced by Kafka and they reject him. And, you know, he's a tricky character. But in the preparation for this podcast, I was thinking about things that reminded me of Kafka. There's a retrospective of the Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke on at the moment. It just came into my head that his film Cachet Hidden is extremely Kafkaesque. You know, there's this kind of surveillance. Mm. There's a kind of this idea of a crime for which the punishment is very, very, is out of proportion with the crime. Haneke himself is obviously Austrian, so he's from that kind of German-speaking world. The White Ribbon has many Kafkaesque elements. Haneke, in fact, made a film version of The Castle, Das Schloss, starring Ulrich Muhr, who's probably most famous to Anglophone audiences in the film Das Leben der Anderen, The Lives of Others, as the kind of Stasi officer who falls in love with his own scheme and the people bound up in it. And actually, as I was thinking, what I'm trying to convey here is when you start thinking of things that are Kafkaesque or have Kafkaesque elements, it's very easy to just get, there's so much there. Even in The Lives of Others, there is a character, a writer, who is sort of drinking himself to death, smoking himself to death, and because he's been stopped producing work by the authorities. And another of his playwright friends, who's one of the main protagonists in the film, sort of pleads his case, in a way, to the corrupt officials, the DDR corrupt officials, one of whom is grossly kind of fat, and there's a kind of nasty, squalid atmosphere around him. And so, as I was thinking through how Kafka pops up, you know, it's pretty easy to see the trial there somewhere in The Lives of Others, this idea of, yeah, people caught up in things where it's quite hard to see where the, you know, what they've actually done wrong, but the process doesn't leave them alone.
But that's going back to the point that it's so difficult to take him out of this Mittel Europa scenario, isn't it? And I think that's why we need new interpretations of him from elsewhere, in a way, because I do think he's a great writer and he's malleable, but it's very, very difficult for us to take him out of that totalitarian, bureaucratic nightmare that we saw emerging in Mittel Europa, and this idea that he represents, he's so representative of that world, his importance to dissidents during the 1970s, 80s in Eastern Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe. He's still, that is his great contribution to the wider culture, in a way, beyond the literature. He was this focal point for people who wished to resist the bureaucracy and the totalitarianism that we read as describing. Mm. But I think if he's a great writer, there is more to him than that. Yeah, so it's questioning, what does he mean now? What might he mean in the future? What light does he shed on current predicaments?
Well, one way of doing that, I think, is, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Carolina, is looking at, you know, if he really was this great inspiration to dissidents, which he was, I would question how consistent their readings were actually of the novel. If you read the trial, he is, you know, there's that idea of complicity. He assents to his punishments at the end, like a dog, he thinks to himself. No one is telling him to think like that. And I think that's what I'm kind of bringing it around to. He's so profoundly difficult and unreassuring and kind of, you know, he really doesn't let up. I think that's one way of kind of reading him against the grain. You know, if Josef K. was innocent of the crime he is accused of, he would be a hero.
But that's precisely the point. Yeah. As those totalitarian systems developed beyond Stalin, they were entirely dependent upon supposedly good people being complicit in that. That's what The Lives of Others is about. Yeah. That is the scary bit of totalitarianism. If it was simply oppression and people being forced by physical force to do something, then we could probably live with that. What people find difficult to live with is that people are themselves complicit in that act. And that's what Kafka described so brilliantly. And that was why he was so important to dissidents at that point.
Caroline, is there a way of reading a novel like The Trial? Perhaps one way of doing it is reading it alongside the rest of Kafka's work and his diaries.
Yeah, so I think, a lot of what you're saying, I think, comes down to also which texts by Kafka are being read, because at least in the English-speaking world, but I think more universally around the world, the two that most people are familiar with are The Trial and The Metamorphosis. Mm. And perhaps also The Judgment. And while they are amongst his great works, they do not really capture the breadth and the variety of the kind of writing that he did. And I think it's useful to, for example, read a collection of his very short stories, some of them just half a page or a page, which often move from sort of strange fable-like stories about animals to these fables set in ancient China, to sort of little sketches of urban life, to sort of aphoristic statements, which in one sentence can sort of take you to the open fields of North America. So you get a much more expansive and varied sense of what Kafka found interesting and where he was looking for creative inspiration. And while a lot about these lesser known writings resonate still with the big themes that we've been discussing here, there's just such a wealth of little moments and turns of phrases and images that really send you in all sorts of different directions that I think that can be a really eye-opening exercise with Kafka. But then another thing, so from what you were saying, the kind of, I guess, anxiety that emerges that many people share is that Kafka has become this sort of commodified good or a brand that people just use as a sort of facile, all-encompassing and thus essentially meaningless descriptor, Kafkaesque, that you can use to describe sort of all sorts of situations that are vaguely threatening or uncomfortable or paradoxical to the point that it loses all meaning. And I don't know, I somehow feel less of that anxiety, partly because to me it's always sort of interesting to really look at the context in which people are putting Kafka to use and sort of trying to understand what work he's doing there. And often the work that he is doing is trying to make sense of current events by putting them in some sort of cultural lineage. And that in itself seems quite interesting to me, you know, that Kafka has become sort of the kind of Shakespeare-like figure who, once you've read Kafka, once you've been exposed to that Kafka fascination, it's impossible to interpret the social and political reality or your own life even without thinking through that lens. You know, I think however accurate or inaccurate that particular instances of using that lens are, I think that in itself is really fascinating to realize that Kafka, you know, somebody who died having not even published most of his works and being known to only a relatively small lit-free universe in Central Europe, has become that, has become a sort of like a global lens on current events. I think he would have been extremely surprised at this turn of events. And then finally, that sort of anxiety about sort of this commercial brand that Kafka has become. I always like to remind myself that Kafka was born into a world where his own family name was already a brand, because his father had a shop selling sort of fancy goods, like sort of nice fabrics and beautiful gloves, those kinds of things. At one point during Kafka's childhood, located bang on the main city square in Prague. And they were using the family name as the brand of that shop. And they even went a step further and sort of utilized the Czech meaning of that word, which is jackdaw, the bird, and actually used a little jackdaw on their logo, on the stationery, which was, you know, technically produced to be used by the shop. But we know that, for example, Kafka would sometimes get letters from his own mother written on that stationery, you know, which she would sign with her name, Julia Kafka, and they would have that little logo with a jackdaw. So I find it quite useful to actually remind myself that actually Kafka, he grew up extremely aware of his own name as a brand, as a symbol, as like a playful, you know, little image. And then Broad spent, you know, decades trying to do essentially effective marketing for the literary vision of Kafka. And many other people were involved too. Another key player in those early decades after Kafka's death was Willy Haas, another member of a similar German-Jewish circle in Prague, who ended up in Berlin in charge of a big literary magazine. And for the second anniversary of Kafka's death, he ran, you know, a series of articles, including on the cover of this magazine, with a photo of Kafka, with one of his unpublished manuscripts, sort of inviting lots of their friends to sort of contribute little pieces about him. There was a whole marketing machine in motion already in the 1920s to make Kafka a household name. And I like to sort of think of all of that when I also see that word Kafkaesque used in so many languages, in so many different contexts.
Another way of thinking about it, I think George Steiner suggests this, is that the divine quality of Kafka's genius is sort of justified by the story that, you know, in the same way as Jesus didn't publish things in his lifetime, you know, and had to have St. Paul to kind of bring the, spread the word, as it were, Kafka had to have Max Brod, with implications both good and bad. You don't have to accept Steiner's view that Kafka had a kind of universal genius that was prophetic. I think as part of that definition, Steiner says the greatest genius of writers is their ability to create parables. And I think Kafka has left us with parables that are still just as mysterious and fascinating as they were 100 years ago. And on that thought, thank you, Carolina. That was absolutely brilliant. And listeners, please do go and read her wonderful book, Metamorphoses in Search of Franz Kafka. Carolina, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was such a pleasure.